All right, welcome everyone to Halachic Divorce 101. I was sitting at the session beforehand. That was Dr. Helfand's session. And there was a lot of talk about vacating Bezin decisions in secular court. The best guarantee that your decision in Bezin will not be vacated is if you demand, okay? I use the word demand, okay? And put it in the arbitration agreement that you want a reasoned opinion from a Bezin, okay? According to New York arbitration law and according to Halacha, there is no requirement to give you a reason for their decision, okay? At the Bezin of America, there are numerous dayanim, including myself, who usually, not all the time, usually give a reasoned opinion. There are some who do not. If you come to the Bezin of America, you insist, okay, that you want a reasoned opinion. If you end up in a Bezin in Brooklyn or in Muncie, because I also serve and was on Zabla's, I don't know if you know what a Zabla is. In New York City, you have standing Bezdins, like the Bezin of America, Machon Lahara in Muncie, the Beis Yosef in Brooklyn. These are recognized Bezdins. You can choose which Bezdin to go to. If the parties cannot agree on a Bezdin, then the only option that you have halachically is a Zavla, which basically means each party chooses a Dayan, and the two Dayanim, the two Jewish arbitrators, pick a third. If you end up in that situation, or if you end up in any other standing Bezdins, again, you put it into the shtar, into the arbitration agreement that you want a reason for your psak. All the arbitration agreements, in particular the ones which are in Brooklyn and Muncie, wherever you go in the New York area, explicitly say they will not give you a reason. Okay? If you want that change, take the ink and cross it out. That is your best protection in terms of avoiding the possibility of a of the psakdin being vacated. Point number two, and that's because of a conversation I just had now with somebody who was sitting, I don't know, still sitting in the room. Before you go to a Bezdin, and as professional as the Bezdin of America is, I've been sitting there for over 10 years, almost 10 years, okay? Make sure you find someone to talk to before you go to the Bezdin of America or any other Bezdin. Don't go blindly to any Bezdin. There are Bezdins that you should never go to. I'm very upfront about these things, okay? There are Bezdins. I recommend highly the Bezdin of America, but it may turn out that you won't be able to go there because the other party will not want to go there. And guess what? After we sit here for about a half an hour, you may figure out why that is the case, okay? Make sure that you become duly informed by speaking to an attorney, speaking to a rabbi, and here again I'll be very explicit about it. Most pulpit rabbis, at least in the New York area, do not know too much about Evin HaEzer, Jewish family law, or Choshen Mishpat. Those aren't the places to go. You have to find information from other rabbis. As I mentioned, this is Halachic Divorce 101. This is not going to be a shiur. This is going to be a practical guide about all the different types of claims, in particular with regard to women, because those are the claims we're really talking about to a great extent, although men are part of the equation also, which can be made in a Bezdin and which are made in all types of Bezdin, partially in the Bezdin of America, partially made in other Bezdins. Now, when you approach a Bezdin, option number one is that the couple can go to the Bezdin of America or any other Bezdin and say they want their issues arbitrated according to halacha. When they say they want to have their marital issues arbitrated according to halacha, that means that they want the Dayanim to open up the Shulchan Aruch. There's 6 or 7 sections on Evin HaEzer, and they want them to resolve the matters according to what it says in the Shulchan Aruch and the Poskim, which we have afterwards. Okay. Once you decide as a couple that you want the Beis Din to resolve the matter according to Halacha, you either put it in the arbitration agreement, and very often it may not be there, or when you come to the Beis Din, you make it very clear, we are here to resolve the matter according to Halacha. I had a Lubavitch couple, which appeared in front of me, this was a sole arbitration, where the wife appeared with someone from the Brooklyn Legal Aid Society, and the husband appeared by himself, and he made it clear more than once he wanted this matter resolved according to Halacha, according to Evin HaEzer. And the wife said, I want this resolved according to secular law. That becomes a problem, and I'm not really discussing it here. But the bottom line is, either it's in the arbitration agreement, or it's clear from the parties that they want the matter to be resolved according to the Shulchan Aruch. So let's go step by step, and this is very practical. The first issue which arises is what happened to you many years ago, assuming you were all married, or one day, hopefully, you will be married, okay, where you have the institution known as the Ksuva, right? That's translated as a marriage contract. Now, the word contract usually means that once you execute an agreement, you have new obligations. And if you ask any yeshiva bacha on the street, oh, what is a marriage contract? All of a sudden, I'm obligated to do things for my wife, right? Obligated to support her, obligated to live with her, etc., etc. This is 100% wrong. The ksuva is basically a debt obligation that the husband assumes. Even if the ksuva would never be executed at a wedding, okay, it is known as a tnai beis din. All your obligations that the husband has vis-a-vis his wife when he gets married are there independent of the ksuva. No ksuva, the obligations exist. Now you all know that the ksuva has value to it, okay? When that ksuva is signed by 2 edim, by 2 witnesses, okay, it says in the ksuva that the husband upon divorce will pay 200 zakukim of kesef. What are 200 zakukim of silver? So there are 3 interpretations, and we're not going into it. We're being very practical. How much is silver worth on the market today? The first approach is the approach which is a Sephardic approach of Rav Na'eh. As of a week ago, according to him, the ksuva was worth $2,259. According to Rav Feinstein, it's worth $26,725. And according to the Chazon Ish, it's worth $31,833. That is basically what I would call the majority approach, how you evaluate the value of the ksuva. There is a minority opinion, and that's the opinion of the Beis Avi, who was Rav Libus, who lived in Brooklyn in the 1950s, and his Talmud, who's now in his late 70s, okay, maybe 80s, Rav Kurizak, as well as the opinion of Rav Shlomo Duchovsky, who simply recently retired from the Israeli Rabbinical Court. They have a totally different approach. There's a Mishnah in Perek Ches and Peah which says, who is considered a person who has money? Someone who has 200 pieces of silver for a year. As understood by the Mefarshim on the Mishnah, that means that basically if a wife had, what it really means is it's a support obligation. You give the wife enough money for food, clothing, and lodging for a year. 200 pieces of silver, which translates today in New York, based upon the cost of living, she would receive approximately $55,000. That is the second approach, like an alimony approach, let's say, to the ksuva. Very few people, I've never heard of any other Dayanim ever use that particular approach. So what do you do today? Do you paskin like Rav Moshe Feinstein or the Chazon Ish or Rav Na'eh? So the Sfardim have no problem, because the Sfardim put the exact money in the ksuva. Okay, it could be $100,000, it could be $50,000. It's in the ksuva. But if you don't paskin like Rav Na'eh, okay, do you paskin like Rav Moshe Feinstein or like the Chazon Ish? So I've sat on a couple of cases at the Bezin of America, and here I'm ready to identify the Bezin of America, where in two cases we followed Rav Moshe Feinstein, and we gave the woman that amount of money, and I had a case where I sat by myself, and for particular reasons, I followed the Chazon Ish. If you go to Machon Lahara, the Av Bezin of Machon Lahara is a Vishnitz Rav, knows more halacha than anybody in Choshen Mishpat, an unreal person, an extremely fair person. He's an accountant also for Vishnitz. For his pleasure reading, he reads Chief Justice Roberts' rules, Chief Justice Roberts, right? Never had a formal education at all, a real genius. He refuses to paskin like any of the three. He basically does an average. The average is Rav Na'eh, Rav Moshe Feinstein, and the Chazon Ish. He would never even consider, even when I had a case, I brought it up to him, will you consider Rav Duchovsky, factor in another $55,000 into your averaging? No way. He says, these are the opinions, those three opinions. So this is the approach with regard to the ksuva. First point with regard to the ksuva. Women have to know that they have to make a claim for the ksuva, okay? It happens invariably, women do not make a claim. When you come to a bezin, you have to make a claim. Do all your due diligence before. It happens to me in Brooklyn. It happens to me at the Bezin of America. They simply don't make a claim. The halacha does not allow a dayan to make a claim for you. You have to make a claim. Now the second point. Do women get the ksuva or not? The reason given in the Gemara, okay, why ksuva was instituted, was a takana drabanan, was to act as a deterrent for a husband to divorce his wife. Now, what deterrent is there today for a husband to divorce his wife when he's only going to pay, let's say, $23,000? In fact, the Rivash, who was a famous Rishon who lived in 14th century North Africa, if I'm not mistaken, said at that time already, the value of the ksuva is never going to be a deterrent. So in fact, it would seem that the ksuva is something which is really insignificant. And what happens when you have a long-term marriage, where people basically have a house, they have assets, the woman hopefully will get, let's say, hundreds of thousands of dollars, then the ksuva is never even given to the woman, because already she's receiving money. She's not going to get the extra $20,000 or the extra $30,000. So long-term marriages where there is money, the chances of getting the ksuva are almost nil. Short-term marriages, as long as you ask, you should be able, and that I've done, whether in Brooklyn or in the Bezin of America, there's no reason why a wife can't get a ksuva. However, and this was a case recently at the Bezin of America, if people get divorced because there's not enough money, we had a case of a woman who divorced her husband because it was just he just wasn't a breadwinner. Okay, that's a reason to get divorced. But she made a mistake. She walked out on him. She left the home with her children. The Bezin would not award her a dime for the ksuva, even though she asked for the ksuva. You can't leave the home and then ask for the ksuva. It's part of being in the marital home. However, if a woman is abused, okay, and leaves the home for what is called a justifiable reason like abuse, or you have a recalcitrant husband who will not give a get, and you're not living together, so you move out, or he moves out, you still will get the ksuva.
Okay. So these are the points with regard to the ksuva.
Now let's get to the more interesting part. Okay. The parts which are actually never presented. Okay. This is the question of property. Okay. Let's assume that a wife has assets prior to marriage. She has a home. She has a condo. She has furniture. She has stocks. Okay. And prior to the marriage, she decides to put it in the ksuva. Or if her father has those type of assets, what we call what? Nedunya. The father is going to gift to the marriage these assets, or she has her own assets. She can put this all in the ksuva. No, I would say nobody. I don't know people who do it. But if you do it, okay, there are two ways of doing it. Either you specify the assets in the ksuva. The furniture is worth $10,000. The house is worth $100,000. You know, on and on. You have your laundry list. Or you give a total figure, $300,000, I'm bringing into the marriage. If you put that into the ksuva, okay, that is what is known in halacha as nichsei tzon barzel, property which is ironclad, like sheep. What does that mean? That means it's in the ksuva. If any day down the road the husband decides to manage those assets and he loses the assets, for example, his wife had $100,000 of stock before marriage and he loses the asset, P.S. And they get divorced, he has to pay every cent that is lost. Every cent that is lost. Now when you put this in the ksuva, as I said, you either put a global amount or a specific amount. If you put a global amount, let's say all the assets are worth $500,000, and among them, let's say, is a house, and for some reason that house is lost because of the negligence of the husband, the only thing that the wife can get is the value of the house when she put it into the ksuva. She cannot receive the house per se because it's been lost, okay? So you have to either specify it or put a global amount. This is what is known as nichsei tzon barzel. As I say, what? Yeah.
When you see a ksuva, there's a boilerplate text.
Right, but everyone signs a boilerplate text.
I'm saying. So are you saying that as an addendum, it should be put in?
I'll get to it later, okay? I'll get to it. You can do whatever you want. You just have to know what to do. You can do whatever you want when you get married. You just have to know. Before I got married, I didn't know what to do, okay? I've learned since, not because of the marriage, but in terms of knowledge. You can do whatever you want to do in this. Almost anything you want to do, you simply have to know who to go to. Now let's get to the more practical part from a halakhic point of view. Most people don't put anything in the ksuva, okay? It's a 200 pieces of silver, that's the end of the story. A woman has property. She acquired it before marriage or acquired it during marriage. She has an apartment house. It was gifted to her by somebody, okay? She acquired assets, whatever the case may be. All this property that she acquired, either that she brought into the marriage or acquired during the marriage, are known as nichsei malug, assets which are called plucking property. That's exactly what it is, plucking property, nichsei malug. The principal belongs to the wife, and any profits which are going to be derived from those assets are to belong to the husband. So, what? Interest. Okay. You have a woman has an apartment building, and you have people who rent, and he's managing that apartment building. All the rent from the apartment building could be interest, could be anything. Any appreciation of that property goes to the husband with one qualification, which we'll mention in wife's bank accounts. Okay. if they're in her name. The account, the principal belongs to the wife. The interest, as you mentioned, belongs to the husband. At the end of the day, should they get divorced, she gets back whatever is there. Okay? She gets back, not necessarily. If he loses the principal, whatever the case may be, loses that apartment and building, she gets zero. Okay? Unlike if she would have put it in where? Into the ksuva. And that's how most women and men enter marriage. Okay? The woman will get zero. Now, let me give you an example from the Bezdin of America. I should have said that, but okay. Bezdin of America. One of the longest cases of divorce of the Bezdin of America. Well over a half a dozen decisions in this particular case. Young couple, known as the golden couple, and I'm not making that part up, in this particular frum community, in this Orthodox Jewish community. They had children. Their marriage lasted approximately 14 or 15 years. The wife had an apartment building. The husband was managing the assets of that particular apartment building. Okay? It's a case of what? Nichsei Melug, where the keren, the principal, belongs to the wife, and the assets, the rent, belongs to the husband. About 10 years into the marriage, the husband got involved continuously with illicit affairs with other women for a period of over at least 5 years. Around the third session, the wife piped up and said, "I'm making a claim for all the money that he spent on his illicit relationships." He had spent, and this is a true figure, supposedly alleged by the wife, of $110,000 on women. The Beis Din painstakingly went through all their assets to try to reconstruct how they paid all their bills, because we had to come to the conclusion somehow, is there any way of finding, tracing $110,000? Not a simple thing to do. I personally spent hours on trying to reconstruct the history of this particular financial history of this particular couple. At the end of the day, we were able to find that $95,000 approximately were monies which the husband used on these affairs. We gave all $95,000 back to the woman for one simple reason. When I mentioned to you before that all profits from property which is owned by the woman, known as Nichsei Melug, are the husband's, there's a caveat to that in the Gemara, and no one argues with that. As long as the husband uses the money, l'revach habayis, for the benefit of domestic budget, that money belongs to him. If he uses it to undermine the family budget, if he doesn't use it for the maintenance of the home, he doesn't use it for tuition, etc., etc., no way. So that was one basis for giving the woman $95,000. And with that money, and it wasn't done for that purpose, this is not a result, Bezdin, they were living in a home. If she would not have received this money, she probably never would have been able to buy the home from the husband, because the home was divided up half and half and she did not have the money for it. With that money and some help from the family, she was able to buy the home. It wasn't done for that reason. It was simply halachically incorrect what he did. That was probably the strongest argument with regard to recouping what's called legally dissipation of assets, wasting assets of a spouse. The second reason is something which you, most of you probably didn't even know it took place. I shouldn't say that. If you are any mechutenistas here in the audience, you all got together with the other mechutenista, right? When you were getting along, and that's probably the only time you were getting along. That's a joke, I suppose. Hopefully, it was only a joke. And you basically broke a bone shiner piece of bone shiner, right? You remember that particular situation. What happened before? There's a love letter. That's what I call it, and others call it, which was prepared by Rav Moshe Feinstein, which is called Tnaim, conditions. So nobody ever reads what's there, like everything else. Like people don't read. If they would read, they wouldn't end up in Beis Din very often. They read what's going on. So in there, you have two interesting lines, okay? The Al Yavrichu, you shouldn't fraudulently transfer. The Al Yalimu, and don't basically obfuscate or make sure something disappears. Lo Zeh Mizu, not the husband from the wife, or Ozo Mizeh, or the wife from the husband. Shum Havrachas Mamon, there should be no fraudulent transfer of Mamon. Ela Yishlitu B'Nechseyem Shava B'Shava, they basically should have equitable control of their assets. This was the second basis for saying there's a rule of transparency in marriage. This fellow was far from being transparent with what was happening in the home. So this was the second reason I gave. And basically, this is based upon the tshuva of the Maharil and the Maharik. It's a very weak argument, because, and I would say the main reason is because neither the husband or the wife sign on this particular love letter. It's signed by witnesses. Just like the ksuva, according to most opinions, it's only signed by witnesses. And in fact, if you go to other Dayanim, one of them being Rob Rosenberg, when I presented that to him, he looked up at me and didn't say a word. And I understood what he meant, because basically it is a very weak argument. But again, it is two arguments. Number one, Nichsei Malug have to be used for the benefit of the home. You undermine the home, you pay back. Okay. And secondly, this particular Sefer Tanan. Now let's get to some practical things. Mm-hmm. People are in a marriage, there's a house, or there is a condo. And we're dealing with it halachically, not according to secular law. Halacha has three approaches how you deal with a marital home. Approach number one is called, at least I call it, the gift approach. If a third party, whoever that person may be, gifts the house to one of the spouses, it belongs to that spouse, okay, if it's gifted. Number two is the funding approach. Whoever pays for the house belongs to them. And the third approach, which is the most prevalent approach, is called the title approach. Whoever is on the title of the house gets the house. You should all make sure that both your names are on the title of the house. If the husband's name is only on the title of the house, there is a good chance if you go to certain bezins, you will never see a penny from that house. I had a case which was an ad hoc panel case. It's been going on for years. They've been to all different bezins and to court. And I met the husband recently. He said he'll never settle. I believe he'll never settle. Where when they bought the initial house, both their names were in the title of the house, both the husband and the wife. Then they sold the house, bought a second house, and bought a third house later on. The purchase price of the first house was like $200,000. The purchase house price of the third house was $700,000. The wife saw money from the first house because she had title to the house. The other two homes where she had no title, she did not receive a penny from the Beis Din. Why she wasn't on the house, she did not know, but as any of you have been to closing, you just sign away, nobody knows what they're doing there. They really don't know. I mean, whether it's the husband or the wife, but this husband was a smart guy. He knew exactly what he was doing. And he made sure that his wife wouldn't have title to the house. And years later, they had a divorce, and it was a very ugly divorce. Make sure you have your name on the title of the house. Whether being on the mortgage will make a difference is a matter of halachic opinion. Because with regard to a mortgage, it may not indicate title. The main reason you may have your name on the mortgage is because the bank wants two names on the mortgage. Title is the most important thing if you go to certain bezdins. Now to the wife's salary. I assume many of you are in homes of two wage earners. What is the halacha with regard to the wife's salary? So according to most Rishonim, except Rabbeinu Hananel, that given the fact that a husband is obligated to support his wife, in exchange for his obligation to support his wife, he receives his wife's salary. It is his salary, even though she worked for it. Rabbeinu Hananel disagrees, okay? And there are some Achronim who also disagree, the Mishnah Lamelech, someone who you know, Rav Moshe Feinstein. Many of the Israeli rabbinical courts in the 50s and 60s disagree. If you open up the Shulchan Aruch, the classical Mefarshim on Simon Pei of Evin Ezer, the Chelkas Mechokek, and the Beis Shmuel also disagree. But my impression is, and that's an impression, I'm not 100% sure about that, in some bezdins you will not see a money from the wife's salary, from your salary. The best thing to do, another piece of advice, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not charging by the hour, put all your money into a joint account. Okay? I had a case again with Rabbi Rosenberg, and the case was as follows. A young couple, she worked and he worked, they had a bank account of $44,000, She got good advice. She called up a rabbi from Far Rockaway, and she was ready to get divorced. And she took out $22,000 from the $44,000 account. So I had the detour with Rabbi Rosenberg, and when you sit with Rabbi Rosenberg, you come well prepared, very well prepared. The first time I went with him, I brought all my sfarim. He said, Rabbi Warburg, I have all these sfarim here in my library. You do not have to bring them. But anyway, I did bring them. And I started arguing what I've been saying until now. This is a wife's salary. There are enough poskim who say that a wife's salary belongs to her, not to the husband. This is Rabbi Warburg. I hear everything you say, but there's this more simple answer to the problem. Forget about the wife's salary. The minute you put money in a joint account, you are basically saying what? That the marriage is an economic partnership. So the wife, as a partner, has a right to take 50% of the money. So this is my recommendation. An accountant will probably recommend it to you for other reasons. Money should be put in a joint account. Severance. You get fired from a job. Let's say a wife gets fired from the job, it is the same problem. The severance pay belongs to you. Any profits from the severance pay will go to your husband, assuming he works with it responsibly. The last type of argument which comes up is the following argument. You've been married many years. The wife comes to the Beis Din, whichever Beis Din she comes to. I've been a homemaker. I've been rearing your children. I've been putting you through medical school or graduate school. I want severance. Okay? That type of argument has been heard in the 1950s and the 1960s and maybe the 70s in the Israeli rabbinical courts. My impression today is that things have changed. Rabbi Yoshev, who sat in the 1950s, Paskin, that there is no basis for awarding that severance. His student, Rav Avraham Sherman, I don't know if you ever heard of him, he wrote this controversial decision with regard to conversion. A student of Rav Eliashib also says there is no basis of severance. In the United States, I've discussed it with other Dayanim, in Brooklyn and in Muncie, and they say they would never award severance under those type of arguments. Interestingly enough, I had a case recently and actually was stunned. I can't tell you who these guys are. I wish I could. I sat on this case, okay? It was a very tragic divorce. Extremely, very nice people. That doesn't happen all the time. When people, just extremely nice people, the man wasn't well, he had a bipolar personality, and he was unwilling to take his meds. That was the whole reason that they got divorced. He wouldn't take his medication. Great wife, a great husband, just nice people. Tragic divorce. She made a claim for his retirement account. She had a pension and he had a pension. But his pension was much more than hers. And she made a claim for whatever amount she made a claim for. I gave all kinds of halachic arguments why the wife should get X amount. And I'm not going into the specifics of what the halachic arguments are. One of the dayanim, who's a very well-respected dayan, at the end said, you know, I hear everything you say, but I'm going to offer a different argument. And I was actually stunned. Because I know the Rav, and I didn't think it would come from him. He said, given the fact that she argued that she was a homemaker, and she reared all the children, they're all out of the house already, and they were married for 25 or 30 years, and given that she was subject to emotional abuse because, you know, he wasn't on his meds. Therefore, she argued she wanted money from the pension. That particular dayan took that argument, very similar to the argument which is accepted in Israel, and she was awarded a certain amount of money, okay? In that particular case, I would have awarded more money because I had other arguments which I felt were stronger, but this is the first time I ever heard in New York, basically in the New York, New Jersey area, any dayan accept that type of severance argument. And especially to hear from that dayan, I was absolutely stunned. Now to answer your question, Mr. Hess, right? This is the default property regime according to halacha. Nisei melug, nisei tzon barzel. The halacha is very, very clear. You're dealing with monetary matters, with money. We paskin like the Chachamim in Kedushin, Yutes, Beis, that we allow private ordering. You can do